Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a new study from the Pew Research Center that finds women are now the primary breadwinners in almost half of all American households. June Carbone, Chair of Law, the Constitution and Society at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and co-author of Red Families versus Blue Families, Legal Polarization and the Creation of Culture, joins us to discuss this tectonic shift in our economy and family life. Then we will speak with pioneering AIDS researcher Dr. Charles Vanderhorst, Professor of Medicine at the University of North Carolina Center for Infectious Diseases. He was recently arrested inside the North Carolina State House protesting against laws that hurt children and the poor that have been passed since the Republicans captured all three branches of government and began a legislative assault on the poor, the unemployed, public education, and voting rights in a flurry of bills that are transforming North Carolina into a model of right-wing governance. Then finally, Stephen Braun, an investigative reporter with the Associated Press, who was previously the national security editor of the AP and author of a book about the notorious Russian arms dealer Viktor Bout, Merchants of Death, Money, Guns, Planes, and the Man Who Makes War Possible, joins us to discuss Russia's arms sales to Syria at the same time that the U.S. and Russia are trying to broker a peace conference in Geneva between the Syrian sides fighting to the death in a bloody civil war. And joining us now is June Carbone, the Edward A. Smith Missouri Chair of Law, the Constitution and Society at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. She writes extensively about legal issues surrounding marriage, divorce, and family organization, especially within the context of the recent revolutions in biotechnology. She is the author of From Partners to Parents, The Second Revolution in Family Law, and co-author of the fourth edition of Family Law. Her latest book, along with Professor Naomi Kahn, is Red Families versus Blue Families, Legal Polarization and the Creation of Culture. Welcome to Background Briefing, June Carbone.
Happy to be here.
And this extraordinary study that's come out from the Pew Research Institute that indicates that more than 40% of U.S. households with children rely on the woman as the chief or only source of income in 2011, up from 11% in 1960. So almost half of America's women are the primary breadwinner today.
Yes, although that's a little misleading. What it indicates is in those households with children, which includes both women who have never married and women who are married and have a spouse in the household who also is an income earner. So it includes two really different groups.
But in general, the fact that it's up 40% from 11% in 1960 would indicate a tectonic shift in social behavior, to say the least.
Absolutely.
And expand on that. What do you think is driving this change?
Well, you have to start with the fact that women are in the workforce. I mean, we treat the family as though it never changes, but the stay-at-home mom is an invention of the 19th century. When the Industrial Revolution hit, the productive activities, think of the farm, making clothes, they went to the factories, and they left. And the home was recreated with the men who used to be home overseeing the farm and the women and the shop. The men left, and we think of the home as this area for child-rearing. But in fact, that's really an anomaly. The home used to be where production took place, and the men and women both worked in the home. Then the men left, and now the women are joining the men in the workforce. And that's a long-scale permanent shift. But lots of other things are happening with the family at the same time.
Well, in many ways, a lot of the analysis about what's happening in our incredibly polarized politics and the hostility that the right wing of the Republican Party have towards Obama is predicated, the Tea Party, is predicated upon the fear of the extinction of the white man's hegemony over economic and social and political life here in the United States. And in many ways, it feels like there's always been this atavistic strain on the conservative right in this country that Ronald Reagan, of course, ran on this shining city on the hill, on this leave it to beaver America, going back to the days of Ozzie and Harriet, the nuclear family, which was very distorted in as much as back then the Latinos and African Americans weren't even counted. So is this realization of this what a lot of people today are thinking, well, boy, this is a pretty earth-shattering statistic here coming from the Pew Research Center. Should we not be taken by surprise, and are we lulled into a false universe because of the atavism of the Ronald Reagans, et cetera?
Well, it's not just that. It's also that what's happening at the top and what's happening in the middle are really different. The one place where men still really out-earn women is at the top. The gender gap in wages has increased at the top, and that group roughly, certainly the entire top 10%, you see men pulling ahead of women in wages, and women still think they marry well when they marry a man who earns more than they do. And so you think of the Romneys as the representative of that, and you think of the Rush Limbaughs as saying that's what we want. But for the rest of the country, that's not real. The gender gap in wages has been narrowing. It's been widening at the top, but narrowing everywhere else. And you really need two incomes. So there are two kinds of myths out there. One is, and you hear this, the Southern Baptists are the most articulate about it, if just women would learn to defer to their husbands, to not ask the men to help out too much around the home, to make them feel good that they're still the head of the family, everything would be right with the family. And that's just not happening. The second myth, and you hear this from Charles Murray, and you hear it from all those people who rail about welfare, if we starve the kids, the women will have to marry the men. And instead, the women have decided to go to work. They can't rely on the men. That's why they're not marrying them. But there's this myth out there that the women are somehow all on welfare, and if we take away the food stamps, they will rediscover marriage. You know, they're discovering the third shift.
Well, but apparently, according to this Pew study, just 28% of Americans surveyed by Pew agreed that it is generally better for a marriage if the husband earns more than his wife. So it seems to me that the other myth that's being shattered here is the myth of the stability of the marriage requires the man.
Well, you know, that's actually a very controversial thing, because we've been looking at those numbers, and what we're finding is, yes, there's a huge shift in attitudes, and that's what people say. And there are lots of marriages that are now called seesaw marriages. You know, one of the big things that's changed is employment stability. It's very hard to stay in a single job for a long time these days. Whether you're at the top or you're at the bottom, if you're at the bottom, you get laid off a lot. If you're at the top, you move more often than you used to in another era because you need to take the opportunities that come to stay ahead of the game. And so as people move, men and women trade off. Husband's laid off, woman works more. Husband has a great opportunity in another city, the wife may move with him, and she's taking care of the kids for a while. They trade off. So when you look at married couples, the temporary turning in and out of the labor market in accordance with opportunities doesn't have much effect on family stability. But when you look at long-term changes and you see men who are moving in and out of the labor force involuntarily, that predicts divorce. You see that the more women are in the labor force, the less housework they do until they start earning more than their husbands, then they start doing more housework. And so we're still sorting through what these changes mean.
Again, I'm speaking with June Carbone, the Edward A. Smith Missouri Chair of Law, the Constitution, and Society of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. She writes extensively about the legal issues surrounding marriage, divorce, and family organization, especially within the context of the recent revolutions in biotechnology. She's the author of From Partners to Parents, The Second Revolution in Family Law, and co-author of the fourth edition of Family Law. Her latest book with Professor Naomi Kahn is Red Families versus Blue Families, Legal Polarization and the Creation of Culture. So let's look at the red family, blue family divide. Of course, red families being in red states, one would think that they were influenced by the pulpit and by religious fundamentalism, which has its patriarchal attributes, to be sure. So is there a difference here, or is this just rhetoric on the part of, you know, the Pat Robinsons of the world who want women to be submissive?
Well, there is a different set of attitudes. And rather than just say different parts of the country, I think we're looking at two differences that do matter, religion and class. So if we look at religion, you certainly see an emphasis in traditional religions that the woman must defer to the man. And you see that if the husband and wife both go to the same church, that tends to have a good effect on family stability. But here's the kicker. When I drive around rural Missouri and I turn on the radio, you hear a lot of religious talk radio, and the message that is really out there is a whole lot of men who aren't doing very well, and they want to feel better about themselves. And there's this outrage. If they're drinking too much, if they've lost their job, if the wife has left them or the girlfriend's left them because they're not earning, you know, they're not reliable. There is a message out there, what you need is religion. A man has to be a man. And when he's a man, the women will defer to him. That message is really powerful in rural America. But it's not working very well with men who can't hold a steady job because the jobs aren't there. They feel unsuccessful, and they stop attending church even if they're still religious. So, you know, the people who are out there who are ready for that are the people who are trying to hang on and feel pretty successful. When you look at the people who are left out of this economy, they're not going to church, and even if they say things like that, they're not making the family work. You need jobs for there to be traditional roles.
So that kind of makes sense then in terms of people like Joel Osteen, the prosperity gospel. You know, God wants you to be a winner, not a whiner. That's the message then, to get the men back into the church and feeling good about themselves.
That's right. And, you know, and the women, you know, if you've got a guy who's doing okay, women have to defer to him. But, you know, there's another side to that, and that's the message that you don't have a job, you're not doing very well in this economy, it's your fault.
Well, that's pervasive on every level, though, isn't it? In conservative circles, that's why we don't have a social safety net in the United States, right, like the Europeans do. They don't have social democracy. Isn't that a part of that general kind of philosophy of, you know, laissez-faire economics and people, in effect, if they're poor, it's their fault?
Mm-hmm. No, that's the message. And there's a wonderful editorial that's been repeated a couple of times in the New York Post. And it basically says teen births aren't the problem. You know, if the parents just go to work, teen births, we can afford them. It's the parents not working we can't afford. And you're thinking, okay, where is this 19-year-old supposed to get a job? The jobs aren't there, but the myth is out there that work is there. You know, you can get your father to lend you money to start a business. You can go pick crops for minimum wage. You know, you can make a go of it. That's the great myth that's out there.
Right. Well, those myths were propagated by Romney, I remember, on the stump. So as a father of a daughter who just graduated, is now a medical doctor, most of her class were women. This Pew report says women are more likely than men to get college degrees. That would seem to be the case today.
Yes, although there's something else going on, too, that makes those statistics look a little different. If you go back, and we've only gotten the figure for 2004. We haven't seen an update. But what we saw in 2004 was a real change. If you look at families who make more than $70,000 a year, they're sending about the same number of boys and girls to college, 51-49 girls, and for African Americans it's 52-48, almost no difference. The place where the boys aren't going to college are from the families in the middle, below $70,000 a year. There's a fall-off. That's where the fall-off is occurring, is from working-class families, from middle America, and from poorer America. At the top, the boys are still going to college. It's those working class families. The girls are going and not the boys.
So what could be done then to break the glass ceiling within the elite? And what explains the fact that the glass ceiling exists within the elite? Is it simply because the elite is the elite and that they...
and the system's rigged.
The system's rigged.
Naomi and I did a little piece for the New York Times on how the wage gap's increasing. And right now it's increasing for women as a whole, which is new. For the last 20 years, it's been increasing for men at the top, are making more. And when you break down those numbers, here's what you find. You find that wages that are competitively set on the basis of skills, think engineers, think pharmacists, women do quite well. You take engineers, the number of women engineers is not growing, but women engineers who are there make 95% of what the men make. Take a look at the financial sector. Financial sector is where it's rigged. CEOs, where the board sets the salaries, it's not a market. It's a board, and the board sets the salaries for the CEOs, and then they go back home and they get their company board to raise their salaries. Where you see that, where you see it's not a competitive market for skills, the wage gap's growing. Where it's skills and the market is tight, women make almost as much as men do. It's very close, once you control for the number of hours worked. So we all know there's a system out there. When you game the system, women don't do as well.
So in other words, the Oprah Winfrey's and the new head of Yahoo, Marissa Meyer, they're kind of window dressing. It's just not a reality that there's equal opportunity at the top.
No, and, I talked to somebody who's a Harvard Law School professor, and she was saying, you know what the guys do? They go and they get an offer someplace else, and they come back to the Harvard faculty and say, you've got to meet this salary or I'm going to leave. She said, you know, in the old days, Harvard met the offer from someplace else and raised everybody's salary. Women did just fine. You know, when they were treated just like the guys, they did just fine, and they did the same amount of work. When it became a star game, now let's see how many outside offers you can rack up so that you get more from the home institution or you jump ship every couple of years. When it shifts in favor of doing that, then women lose out.
Well, in terms of the divide, though, that your most recent book, June Carbone, along with Professor Naomi Kahn, Red Families versus Blue Families, Legal Polarization and the Creation of Culture. Sometimes living out here on the West Coast, on the left coast, in the California Republic, you start to feel that you're in a different country. You know, the state has a surplus. We have very different politics from the rest of the country. And you know, I think about a sixth of the world's economy. The state of California is equal to, you know, I think it's in sixth place in terms of an economy. And the impression I get, and you may need to correct me here, is that we're sort of moving into the 21st century, and a lot of the people in the red states are moving back to the 14th century, and the American Taliban are alive and well in setting moral standards. And the irony is, of course, in the state of Mississippi, in the heart of the red states, I believe there's even a greater divorce than there is, for example, in California or in New York. So are there two Americas drifting in opposite directions?
Yes, and they're getting worse. What's happening here in the heartland, is Kansas. Governor Brownback is among the most radical governors in the country, trying to eliminate the state income tax with funding from the Koch brothers. They had a little coup in the legislature where they got rid of the moderate Republicans. So now that the legislature is under the control of the really right wing, and they can't pass a budget because Brownback's plan was, let's make all the fat cats really rich, get rid of the income tax, but raise or keep the sales tax high on poorer people. And the radical legislature, his handpicked supporters, aren't passing this measure to keep the increase in the sales tax, which will bankrupt the state budget. Now, you ask yourself, what's in Kansas now? The state is depopulating in the rural areas. What's in Kansas now are some of the best public schools in the country, and Brownback claims to support funding for education, but the budget that's there can't support the schools they have now. And you've got the Koch brothers, who control the interior of the state that's losing population. And Missouri has a Republican legislature, a Democratic governor, and the Republican legislature is saying, me too, let's get rid of our sales tax so we can compete with Kansas. And what that will do is it will bankrupt the future. You know, we don't have, we have a bridge that collapsed in Missouri recently. We don't have money to fix it. There's the recession. There's been a defunding of higher education, of schools in the state. The economy is recovering if you gut the sales tax, I mean, gut the income tax and don't raise the sales tax. There won't be the money for education. There won't be the foundation for the future. When I came, Missouri was razor thin, a battleground state. Today, Missouri is solidly red because the best educated of the students leave for college and don't come back.
Well, June Carbone, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
I enjoyed it. I admire what you're doing. Keep up the good work.
Thank you very much. Again, I've been speaking with June Carbone, who's the Edward A. Smith Missouri Chair of Law, the Constitution, and Society at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. She writes extensively about the legal issues surrounding marriage, divorce, and family organization, especially within the context of the recent revolutions in biotechnology. She's the author of From Partners to Parents, The Second Revolution in Family Law, and co-author of the fourth edition of Family Law. She, along with Professor Naomi Kahn, are the co-authors of Red Families versus Blue Families, Legal Polarization and the Creation of Culture. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with a prominent doctor who was arrested inside the North Carolina State House protesting against radical Republican programs that hurt children and the poor.
To be a woman and to be turned down. Change your name when so many love you. Is it the same? It's the woman in you that makes you wanna play this game.
Come, senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't lock up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are a-changing.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is pioneering AIDS researcher Dr. Charles Vanderhorst, a professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina's Center for Infectious Diseases. His writing has been published in The Washington Post, The Guardian, Swimming Magazine, Endurance Magazine, and The Independent Weekly. He was recently arrested inside the North Carolina State House while peacefully demonstrating against laws that hurt children and the poor. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Charles Vanderhorst.
Thank you very much, Ian.
So what's happened to your state of North Carolina? Only 5 years ago, people were in the streets celebrating the victory of Barack Obama in 2008, the first Democratic candidate to capture the state since Jimmy Carter in 1976. And yet, 2 years later, in 2010, with enormous funding from the Koch brothers and the American Petroleum Institute, Karl Rove and others organized a counter-revolution, if you will, where the state of North Carolina, the Republicans have captured all branches of both the Assembly, the Senate, and the governorship. So what happened in such a short period of time?
So what happened was that, first of all, one of the key instigators of that switch was a man named Art Pope, who's his family owns Family Dollar stores, and they're quite wealthy, and he did polls in districts in North Carolina where the Democrats were holding office, and he identified 22 districts which he thought could be flipped with a large amount of money, And the large amount of money was only $2 million, which is not a large amount. And he spent $2 million on 22 districts and flipped all those seats to Republicans in an off-year election. So that was in 2010. That was the time of the census, as you know, and we're redistricting. So they redistricted all the districts to make it so that there were fewer congressmen running in Democratic-controlled districts for the federal House of Representatives, and so they've gerrymandered the state, so it's going to be this way for another 7 years until the next census. So that's what happened. So this is the first time the three branches, three parts of the government, the Assembly, the Senate, and the governorship, have been in Republican hands since time of Reconstruction after the Civil War. And when the governor took charge in January, they instigated a program that affects literally every citizen and every phase of their life. So if you just focus on the medicine things, they decided to not expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act to 500,000 working North Carolinians. So these are not the poor who already qualify for Medicaid, but the working poor who pay taxes. They've proposed legislation that all school children be taught that if you have an abortion, it means you're going to have preterm births ever after, which is, of course, complete fiction. They've proposed a law that a depressed teenager or a teenager who could potentially have a sexually transmitted disease or pregnant would have to get a notarized permission slip from their parents to get any medical care. And if they were emancipated minor, so not living with their parents, they'd have to go to a judge. They've banned the use of the federal exchanges under the Affordable Care Act for abortion in our state. They want to privatize Medicaid, and it goes on and on. All the independent commissions we had in the state, so moving beyond medical issues, all the independent commissions like the Coastal Resources Commission, the Power Commission, et cetera, that regulate rates, they passed a law that allowed the governor to fire all the commissioners and put on that were usually scientists and academics and community people and put all his buddies. So now developers are the ones who are controlling our Coastal Resources Commission. They are cutting my taxes, and I'm a true one percenter. We're a two-physician family. They're cutting my taxes by 50%, and they're starting a new tax on, get this, food, medications, and doctor's visits. So this is going to affect the elderly on fixed incomes. It's the biggest tax increase that we've ever seen, and these are supposedly conservative Republicans who are doing this. They've cut eligibility for preschool education from 200% of the poverty level to 100%, and also the amount of money, so the number of positions. And the one thing that we do that Jim Heckman, the University of Chicago Nobel laureate, has shown that is the most cost-effective thing we can do in a person's life is to give them preschool education. It'll have the greatest benefit. So I could go on and on for 40 minutes, but I'll leave it at that.
Well, again, I'm speaking with pioneering AIDS researcher Dr. Charles Vanderhorst, a professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina's Center for Infectious Diseases. He was recently arrested inside the North Carolina State House while peacefully demonstrating against laws that hurt children and the poor. Now, these protests have started to build. 17 were arrested initially, then 30 more were arrested, and then a week later, 49, and last week, 57 were arrested. So there's a growing backlash. But I guess the question is, why cutting the, as the General Assembly and Governor McCrory have done, cutting the earned income tax credit which affects 900,000 poor and working families, rejecting funding for Medicaid that covers 500,000 North Carolinians without health insurance, slashing state unemployment benefits, rejecting federally funded emergency unemployment compensation for 170,000 laid-off workers. The more you look into this, it just feels like mean-spiritedness. It doesn't. In other words, you know, this is federal money they're getting. It doesn't cost them anything. Why are they doing this?
I think it is mean-spirited. I mean, it's hard not to use the word evil because, you know, this is, you know, lack of health insurance. Just focus on that, the Medicaid lack of health insurance. That it devastates people. It means they can never leave their jobs if they're working poor, because if they so it affects the business community, small businesses, because you're tied to your job, because if you lose your health insurance, you can't travel. It drives up our health costs. So economically, it makes no sense. Again, if they were real fiscal conservatives wanting to save money, they would have expanded Medicaid, because one of the things that's driving up the cost of health care for all of us is uninsured people who don't get preventive care. So rather than getting their blood pressure treated or their diabetes treated, it gets out of control and they end up with a $100,000 hospital admission, which then, of course, increases your Blue Cross, Blue Shield, and Aetna costs. So, because these people are still going to get sick. Just because we don't expand the program doesn't mean those people aren't going to come to the hospital. In fact, I would say that a third of our hospital admissions in my state are because of people having inadequate preventive care because they don't have health insurance. So it is completely mean-spirited, and it's so filled with hypocrisy, it's amazing. So these people, they spend a lot of time talking about the sanctity of life, you know, but what they mean is they really care about the fetus. The minute that fetus turns into a baby, a living, breathing baby, outside the womb, they turn their backs on the baby. They say, okay, you're not going to have health insurance. We're not going to pay for preschool. We're going to cut food stamps so you can't have those. So they could give a damn about these babies. They also want to restrict the right to vote. And so they want, because they want to say, well, we have to have voter IDs. So you would say, oh, okay, that's fine. But then why are you cutting the number of days that people can vote? That has nothing to do with voter ID. In fact, you could argue that we're going to have less chances for fraud if you allow people to vote at a leisurely, 2 weeks prior to the elections without lines, so the computers can check and make sure that this person is a legitimate voter. So I think they're just evil and hypocritic. At least that's all I can think of.
Well, specifically, there are 30,000 children in North Carolina who previously qualified for pre-kindergarten programs that the state had. Now they've made these programs off limit for 30,000 preschool kindergarten children. So there's what they think about children once they're born, as opposed to the sacred fetus. And in terms of the voting, they want stricter forms of IDs, repeal same-day voting registration, cut early voting from 17 days to 6, and ban early voting on Sundays. So it's pretty clear, but what's not clear is how do these people call themselves Christians?
Well, I'm a nice Jewish boy, but I have a really hard time with that. They certainly, I studied the New Testament, and I've got a lot of Christian friends, and I was locked up with a bunch of Baptist preachers and Methodist preachers when I was arrested. So I don't know. They clearly are not reading the same Bible that I've read or the same New Testament. I mean, they're just mean-spirited, and they, it's just appalling.
But can they really cement these changes, which they appear to do? Not only are these changes radical and reactionary, because they're changing the voting laws to sort of ensure their permanent tenure, they look like they really, this is not a flash in the pan revolution. This is some real long-term strategy involved in this. They want to control this state and continue, I take it, to favor the rich and punish the poor and turn North Carolina into the model of the new American conservative movement.
Well, I, you know, that does worry me, but there are, I think, reasons for hope. So one thing is, if you want to win an election, you always need the center. And the center gets turned off when people do these sort of scorched earth policies. I mean, they'll, you know, the center, and that's one of the reasons we're doing the protests and why I felt very comfortable being arrested, is that when they see what's happening, because most people don't understand that, but when they see it's going to have an effect on them, when they're cutting the university system by $100 million, so that means tuition is going to go up, that's going to affect the middle class. When they see that their insurance rates go up because we're not expanding Medicaid, that's going to affect the middle class. So I think people don't like extremists, and these folks are extremists. I think secondly is that McCrory, Tillis, and Berger, McCrory's the governor, Tillis is the Speaker of the House, and Phil Berger is the Senate president. They all have their eyes on higher office. Tillis is probably going to challenge Senator Kay Hagan in this next election. And, you know, the voters won't like extremists, and these folks are leading a pack of rabid dogs. And so I think this will damage them. And then finally, I think when you get the outside world looking in, so the Koch brothers and Pope were, and the Republicans were pouring in money here, but I think you're going to start seeing that these demonstrations are getting larger and larger. So Monday is going to be huge. So, you know, I've gotten just emails from tons of people since I was on the front page of the paper 3 weeks ago that they are bringing busloads of people on Monday from all over the state. There's now there're going to be four rabbis showing up, and I think you're going to see this is going to keep on getting bigger and bigger as long as they keep doing this stuff. And a lot of these decisions can be undone. The Medicaid expansion could be reversed quickly.
Well, Dr. Charles Vanderhorst, I thank you very much for joining us here, and this is a pretty alarming report that you've given us, and I take it that Art Pope, the multimillionaire who put up $2.2 million to buy the legislature and the governorship, I'm sure he's getting enormous rewards at the expense of everybody else. So again, I thank you.
My pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with pioneering AIDS researcher Dr. Charles Vanderhorst, a professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina Center for Infectious Diseases. He was recently arrested inside the North Carolina State House while peaceably demonstrating against laws that hurt children and the poor. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with an expert on Russian arms sales.
You never give me your money. You only give me your funny paper. And in the middle of negotiations, you break down. I never give you my number.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Stephen Brown, who is currently investigative reporter for the Associated Press and was previously national security editor for the Associated Press. He is the co-author, along with Douglas Farah, of a book about the notorious Russian arms dealer Victor Boot, Merchants of Death, Money, Guns, Planes, and the Man Who Made War Possible. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Brown.
Thanks, Ian.
And obviously, there's a lot of arms are about to pour into Syria. There's been a reluctance on the part of the West to supply arms to the rebels, but now the EU have voted, contentious vote nonetheless, have voted to allow the ban on the on export to the rebels to expire on Saturday. This has prompted the Russians to send warnings that they're going to send S-300 ground-to-air missiles, the Deputy Foreign Minister of Russia saying that this would be a stabilizing factor that could dissuade some hotheads from entering the conflict, referring to the EU. So it looks like there's an arms race underway.
Well, possibly. I mean, remember that Russia has been very careful when there have been several attempts in the UN over the last few years to install an arms embargo against the Syrian government. You know, the Russians have stepped in and basically, you know, made sure that the Security Council couldn't do that. So they, you know, they've sort of tipped their hand, you know, even before this, that they were going to make sure that their strong client, which was the Syrian government, was protected. And in this case, you know, it's sort of an extension of that policy. They're now saying, if arms start to flow to the rebels, then they'll simply pour in more to the Syrian government.
But there's a further complication to this, and that is that the Israeli defense minister said that, talking about the S-300s, the shipments haven't set out yet, and I hope they won't, said Moshe Yalon, the deputy, the Israel's defense minister. But he continued saying, but if they do arrive in Syria, God forbid, we'll know what to do. So you could have the Russians and the Israelis duking it out, could you not?
Well, I mean, I suppose conceivably, but it's highly remote. I mean, in essence, what the Israelis are trying to do here is maintain their air superiority, which obviously showed recently when they went after sites near Damascus. But, you know, I think before the Syrians tangled with the Russian government, I think we would see some folks stepping back. It's hard to imagine that getting to that extreme.
Well, of course, they're supposed to be having a peace talk, which was arranged, I believe, because there's a personal connection between the Foreign Minister Lavrov and the new Secretary of State, John Kerry. Kerry was able to persuade the Russians to join in a peace talks that will take place in Geneva. But now you have all this jockeying over the arms. It doesn't sound like peace is in the wind. It sounds more like war's in the wind.
Well, yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, I'm more conversant in the arms side of this this situation than the diplomatic side. I think we've got a long way to go. Everybody's talking. So at this stage, I think you know, the arms sales are they're the newest flavor here, but it remains to be seen where this heads.
Again, I'm speaking with Stephen Brown, who's currently investigative reporter for the Associated Press and was previously the national security editor for the AP, and he is co-author, along with Douglas Farrar, of a book about the notorious Russian arms dealer Viktor Bout, Merchant of Death, Money, Guns, Planes, and the Man Who Made War Possible. So if indeed the Russians are sincere about trying to bring about a diplomatic solution, and as they have expressed many times, they have genuine concerns about the nature of the Syrian opposition, particularly the more radical groups, al-Nusra, who appear to dominate the opposition, being Sunni jihadists who would inspire jihad in the Russian Caucasus, where, of course, recently we became aware of that because of the Boston bombers. So they have some fairly, I think, credible arguments about the nature of the Syrian opposition. But at the same time, one is sort of suspicious and somewhat skeptical of Russia's motives. I believe that 1 in 5 Russian industrial workers is in the arms business, and Syria is a huge arms client. So how much are Putin and company in this for the money and to hold on to their naval base in Tartus?
Well, I mean, unlike some of their main competitors, I mean, the United States being a pretty strong example, I mean, the Russian government has continued to boost its arms exports in recent years. But one thing you also have to remember is that the bulk of the money that Russia is spending these days on defense is spending on, you know, basically repairing its own very, very tattered arms inventory. They let for years, they let everything from planes to new weaponry slide, and so most of their money has been going into boosting their own armies' stocks. But I mean, Syria is clearly a strong client. There are other places where they're hoping to make inroads, Africa, Latin America. But the loss of Syria would put a dent into their arms sales. But they are already casting about and have been in recent last few years to try to open up a new entree elsewhere, just in case things like this happen. So they've been working hard with India, for example. They still have a certain amount of sales in China that they're still a big client. So, you know, a loss of Syria would hurt, but it wouldn't kill off the Russian arms export industry by any case.
And how much does Putin control things? I mean, he is often, you know, Russia's often referred to as KGB Incorporated under Putin, whose cronies seem to be throughout the Kremlin, and he seems to be in many ways the sort of the boss of the bosses, if you will, regulating organized crime, if you will. So has the freewheeling days of under Yeltsin, when overnight billionaires were plundering state assets and people like Victor Boot were able to get his hands on this vast inventory of arms, are those days over?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's starting in 2000. You know, Boot consolidated the various top arms exporters into one, and he maintains a very tight rein over that operation. Even Boot, when he was nabbed by the U.S. in 2008, it's very interesting. Prosecutors were very, very careful not to show him as an agent of the Russian government, but the top informant in that case talked about meeting Boot at a major military industrial building in Moscow. So it was sort of implied, but never stated overtly. But in essence, Boot had been reeled back too by 2008. So it's different than it was in the 60s. It's not the sort of the ideological backed pipelines that we saw back then, basically used to foment revolution around the globe. This time, it's basically to bring money back into Russian coffers. But they're trying to revive some of those pipelines, and they're trying to get new clients. But all of that is being largely directed out of Moscow and through the military complex there.
And when the DEA nabbed Boot in Thailand, I believe, the Russians protested, saying that the U.S. is operating on a double standard, that they were selling arms all around the world, and this was hypocrisy. Did they have a case here? I mean, and why was the DEA involved?
Well, I mean, they did somewhat. I mean, in essence, you know, the Russians could say, well, you know, here is a guy who is essentially our proxy, and you know, you nabbed him while he was, you know, doing our government's will, but they weren't willing to say that publicly. So they couldn't make that argument unless they were willing to acknowledge that he was working for them, which they couldn't do. And there was always sort of a gray area about how much they were willing to say, and indeed how much rope they were willing to give him. But as long as, you know, both of the goals of Boot and the Russian government went in the same direction, they were, you know, they allowed him to do what they needed to do. So, yeah, there was a certain amount of hypocrisy. They could have made that argument, but they, in essence, weren't willing to do so because it would have, you know, it meant acknowledging what he was doing. There's a new new potential case on the horizon that could affect some of that, and where some of this may come into daylight. Boot's right-hand man, a guy by the name of Richard Cicciocli, just was extradited last weekend to New York, and he's going to be facing charges related to Boot's arrest back in 2008. If Chachakli testifies for the government, if he turns state witness, if you will, that could provide a whole new slew of details.
And he's a Russian citizen. And where did they extradite him from?
Yeah, he was in Moscow, but when Boot was arrested, he, for some inexplicable reason, decided to surreptitiously go to Australia, where he ran a carpet business for a while, but then eventually tried to get a job with the police force in Victoria. And they caught him, they checked his fingerprints, and so he was arrested. So, he was Boot's right-hand man. He knew everything about the operation. And, that should be an interesting trial.
It should be an interesting trial, but it also makes you wonder whether he was the brightest bulb in the...
Are we talking about this fellow, or are we talking about Boot?
Well, no, I'm talking about this guy. If he wanted to be a cop, he must have known that they would have done a fingerprint check.
He's a strange character, but apparently he's a wizard at all kinds of financial ledger domain, particularly in putting together shell companies. So, as unhinged as he might have been, he did have his uses.
So, again, what has Putin done then to rein this in? He doesn't use these cutouts like Boot as front man.
It's much more like our operation. I mean, for example, there's a lot more transparency today than existed in the 60s. In the 60s, we had no idea. The Russians never told us, you know, directly who their clients were, how much they were sending to them. These days, there are all sorts of analysts, Russian analysts, who talk about it, and all those figures are available if you go, if you start searching the web. So you have to give them that. It's not being done in the dark. But at the same time, particularly when you talk about very sensitive clients like Iran or Syria, back during the days when Gaddafi ran things in Libya, not everything is done overtly. And if they want to, you know, make a deal for a particular sensitive armament, or, for example, surface-to-air missiles, they may not announce that, or they may, it may be done, and in the details may not be as overt as the United States might suggest. So that's where somebody like Boot can, and at times did, play a role. Or, you know, if they're selling to Hezbollah, for example, the Iranians. It depends on the client, and it depends on the circumstances.
But in terms of the Iranians now, the Russians have shown some restraint with these same missiles that they're sending or threatening to send to Syria, the S-300s, which Israel is basically saying if they go to Syria, as far as we're concerned, they'll end up in Hezbollah's arms and they're fair game for us. The Iranians wanted the S-300s as a deterrent against an Israeli strike on Iran's nuclear facilities. Russia I believe the West twisted Putin's arm a bit on that. And they haven't delivered them, have they? And they haven't delivered them to Syria yet. So
No. But at the same time, you know, the Russians also have talked about giving the S-300s to Turkey and to doing some mutual defense work there. So the Israelis haven't, as far as I know, haven't made a peep about that. So again, I mean, all of this depends on the circumstances, and there's a certain amount of gamesmanship. It remains to be seen whether the Russians are going to actually go forward with that. It's one thing to talk about it and to essentially potentially give Assad a bluff. The question is, are they going to deliver? All of that, still remains to be seen here. I don't think we've suddenly rushed. At least it would be hard to say at this point that things have reached a more dire episode than they've been in recent weeks. There's a lot of talk here, but
the ship hasn't sailed, right?
Not yet.
Yeah. So, but in terms of Russia's, responsibility, if there's such a thing in the arms world, showing some restraint and responsibility, most of what they transfer is light arms and, pretty much Cold War stuff. I mean, these new missiles are fairly advanced. Because, for example, we transfer a lot of stuff to Israel, and the Israelis have a massive arms industry. And they then turn around and sell a lot of stuff to China, which irritates the U.S. because they upgraded China's Air Force and upgraded their entire inventory of tanks, for example. So what kind of restraint, again, do they show in terms of really upgrading potential adversaries around the world?
We talk about the Russians?
Yeah.
Again, I think it depends on the case. If it got to the point where we felt, where the United States government felt that they were tipping, a particular situation into one that was particularly dangerous, i.e., what we're talking about in Syria, I think you'd see a lot of diplomatic maneuvering before we got to that point. And I don't see that at this stage. Obviously the very fact that Lavrov and Kerry continue to negotiate shows that it's one thing to raise that possibility, but I don't think we're anywhere near that point yet. I don't see any evidence.
Right. Well, but when you mentioned the guy down in Australia who was Boot's right-hand man, the idea that he was a carpet salesman and was looking for a job would indicate to me that there may be a lot of these Russians wandering around the world that have tremendous amount of arms knowledge and perhaps even weapons of mass destruction knowledge. Are there a lot of them on the loose?
Well, there are always little cases that pop up in Eastern Europe of folks with, there have been a number of these cases where folks pop up with a certain amount of, I don't know if you call it WMD, but you know, there's a certain amount of radioactive material in hand. Although obviously that's a continuing concern of the U.S. and folks have raised this, repeatedly with the possibility of this material getting into the hands of an Al Qaeda or an Al Qaeda like, a terror organization. Here it is. It's we've known that Al Qaeda has been after this material since at least 2002. It's now 2013, and we still have yet to see any, case where they clearly have been able to, to get this material, number one, and then use it. So I think the international efforts, as far as I can tell, have been pretty robust, and their track record speaks for itself.
Well, just in closing, Stephen Brown, were you one of the AP reporters that phones were tapped? I mean, I know you're no longer the national security editor at the Associated Press, which would make you a prime target for the Justice
Right.
Department's
Right.
sweeping wiretaps. But were you caught up in that?
No, my phones were not the target of any of these, as far as I know.
Right, but you must have
as far as I know.
Right, but you must have an opinion on it. It's happened to your colleagues.
Oh, I might, but that's for AP's management stock.
Okay, I'm assuming you're not happy about it. Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Stephen Brown.
Sure.
Bye bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and I was just speaking then with Stephen Brown, who's currently the investigative reporter for the Associated Press. He was formerly the national security editor for the AP and a former national correspondent based in Washington for the Los Angeles Times. He shared the Times' 1991 Pulitzer Prize for coverage of the Los Angeles riots and is the co-author, along with Douglas Farrar, of a book about the notorious Russian arms dealer Victor Boot, Merchant of Death, Money, Guns, Planes, and the Man Who Made War Possible. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Nick Garino. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was